I'm Andrew L. Sorkin, and you're listening to Squawk Pod.
Bring in show music, please.
This is Squawk Pod, the daily podcast brought to you by the team behind Squawk Box.
NYC, this is CNBC Control 2.
CNBC's essential morning show.
PCR 2.
Every day, get the best stories, debate, and analysis from the biggest names in business and politics.
All right, we're coming to it next.
Today, subtweeting.
This Twitter stuff is kind of interesting.
It's fascinating.
Twitter CEO banning political ads just before Facebook CEO jumped on his company's quarterly earnings call.
It was totally trolling.
The push to end vaping.
28% of high schoolers are vaping and 5% of middle schoolers are vaping. These statistics are alarming and the trend is not good.
Congressman Raja Krishnamurthy urging the White House to pull flavored e-cigs from the market. And Silicon Valley veteran Jeff Yang.
We're definitely under fire.
Why move fast and break things may be over. We've got those stories and a lot more. I'm CNBC producer Katie Kramer. It's Thursday, October 31st, 2019.
Happy Halloween.
Thanksgiving's coming.
Thanksgiving is coming.
not far off.
Is here.
Squawk Pod begins right now.
Stand Becky by in 3, 2, 1. Cue, please.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Squawk Box here on CNBC. We are live from the NASDAQ market site in Times Square. I'm Becky Quick, along with Joe Kernan and Andrew Ross Sorkin.
First up on the podcast today, news breaking early this morning from a Bloomberg report that says Chinese officials have been casting doubt about the possibility of a long-term trade deal with the U.S. and the Trump administration.
That report says that the officials are concerned about President Trump's impulsive nature and the risk that he may back out of even a limited deal.
In the report as well, it said that they don't plan on budging on some of the big issues, some of the most contentious issues. I hearken back to Rick Scott when he comes in and just says nothing. The senator, Rick Scott, just says nothing. They're not going to do anything. But it also, is it a coincidence that the S&P is at a new high? And again, sometimes I think over here we think we've got some house money again. The markets are fine. They've hit new highs. Let's put the pressure back on. Did we exert any pressure? Was this totally unilateral?
Chile canceled the APEC meeting where we were not going to be able to potentially sign. So that does complicate it a little. It sounds like both sides still would like to sign something.
And both sides jawbone. They do. Yeah. They both say and over in China at this point now, and there's an election coming here.
And the Chinese know that.
And I don't know whether they'd be better served with somebody else or whether the impulsive nature of President Trump is really something that they don't want to deal with.
But subtly, though, they have a point. He does tend to say,
but he put us in this position in the first place. Right. Suddenly, we are confronting China, and I think there's probably a majority of Americans that want to do this now.
There's
and that was not the way it was a year ago.
Politicians on both the right and the left.
This is not going back in the toothpaste. The genie's not going back in the toothpaste tube.
But I think this goes back to the sort of larger issue of, A, do they do anything big at all? And if the idea is...
Are they capable of doing anything big at all?
Well, the question is, are they capable of doing anything big ever?
IP-wise.
But if they're going to do something big, do you do it now or do you wait? And that's always been the issue.
I don't think they'll ever do it.
They make some agricultural purchases.
That's what put them where they are. That's what, right. Jettison them to the top of the global economy.
On why they might eventually come along on IP theft is that now that they have their own companies that are creating a lot of intellectual property, they may be in a slightly different position where they would like to protect some
really
of it at some point.
Their
but
own,
that will also admit that they've been stealing it for years, and that's a heavy lift for them.
So you tell me, though, you think this house money idea that you have is going to be used now?
When the president gets back to where he can say we're at all-time highs, I think he turns the screws on the Chinese.
I think he may tone it down a little bit. I think from what he's done in the past.
Has he got anything else going on?
Well, he's got other stuff going on. He's got an election coming up, and he wants the economy to be strong heading into the next year. So even though he may feel like he has some house money, my guess is he's not going to be quite as strident as he has in the past on other situations.
Also new this morning, Fiat Chrysler and Peugeot announcing their intention to merge. The automaker saying the deal would involve a 50-50 stock swap. Fiat Chrysler's chairman, John Elkann, would become chair of the new company, while Peugeot's chief executive, Carlos Tavares, will become the CEO with an initial 5-year term. If this deal clears all the hurdles, it would create what would be the world's fourth largest automaker by sales, with a combined worth of more than $48 billion. This is the second attempt by Fiat to form a merger of some sort. This one, by the way, looks like it's going to be getting the support of the French government, which was what had held up the transaction with Renault that John Elkann had tried to pursue earlier this year. So a big deal in that space. The question is whether it's enough for Fiat and Peugeot. It definitely helps them. It's better than no deal in terms of being able to cut costs and things like that, but it doesn't necessarily help in the same way that the Renault deal would have done in terms of getting yourself into China, EVs and electric vehicles and electric cars, and how that all is going to work. But this may be a multi-step process.
You mean talk before about, you fold somebody else in?
I wonder whether this is, you do this, you spend a year or two setting this up, and then, you know, and the sad part is the French government should have probably pursued the Renault deal because it would have strategically gotten a lot of these things done a lot quicker.
Right.
But that's why I said it's a multi-step world.
I saw Peugeot, I think it was 2016 on the road.
Yeah.
I think. I'm not sure. I'm not sure of the year.
Twitter announcing it will ban political advertising ahead of the 2020 presidential campaign in a series of tweets. CEO Jack Dorsey saying political message reach should be earned, not bought. The new rule applies to both candidate ads and issue ads as well. And the final policy will be released on November 15th and will take effect on November 22nd. The policy is a stark difference from the other tech companies. Mostly, of course, Facebook. Less than 2 hours after Twitter announced that policy, Mark Zuckerberg speaking on the Facebook conference call about the decision to continue running political ads. Here's what he had to say.
Although I've considered whether we should not carry these ads in the past, and I'll continue to do so, on balance, so far I've thought that we should continue. We estimate that these ads from politicians will be less than 0.5% of our revenue next year. So that's not why we're doing this. To put this in perspective, the FTC fine that these same critics said wouldn't be enough to change our incentives was more than 10x bigger than this. So the reality is that we believe deeply that political speech is important, and that's what's driving us.
And the Trump campaign responded to Twitter's ad ban, saying Twitter just walked away from hundreds of millions of dollars of potential revenue, a very dumb decision for their stockholders. So this is now getting political, of course. It may be worth hundreds of millions of dollars in the future, but right now for Twitter, it's a measly, I think, $3 million.
I think 2016, so that's all they had for
it. It's not moving the needle for them. Yeah. Having said that, I have to say there's an element of, you know,
ludicrous. It's ridiculous.
You think it's ludicrous?
I think it's ridiculous to say that they have to earn it and not advertise. Do you know what a political campaign would be if you didn't have money to spend on ads? You would never know any of the lesser candidates. Do you know when media companies report earnings in either in a national election or a two-year election? Do you know that in the earnings it says boosted by political
Correct.
Spending?
Yes.
You want to live in a world where how are you going to organically find out about the newest candidate, Andrew?
I think the issue is I think what Jack Dorsey's made a decision about is either you accept no advertising or you have to figure out a way to police the advertising. And right now, it is too hot an issue about how to police the advertising. So he's chosen
I understand.
Not to.
But the statement he made,
he put this
you
out
need to earn it, not buy
Facebook's
it.
Earnings.
Well, that's
by
that's
earning
absurd.
It, by the way, this does not prevent President Trump.
No, I know. I'm not saying but
he's in a
unique position.
He's in a very unique.
You know, Amy Klobuchar doesn't have 24 million followers,
Correct.
60 million followers.
Correct.
Look, we know right now we hear that Vice President Biden, his fundraising is down. That's going to be an issue when you got other people with 25 million in the back. And how do they use it? They use it for political ads. That's the way things work. If you want to, you know, I've heard about Citizens United and money in politics and all these high flung ideas. That's not the real world. That's not how it works. And if you got 17 people running for president, the bottom 15 aren't going to get anywhere without political advertising.
I completely
agree. Okay, then
the issue to me is about, well, first of all, I would actually, you know, like to take money out of politics.
I know you would, and I know.
Slightly different. I'd actually allow you to advertise and cap the amount that everybody can spend.
Okay.
Meaning everybody can spend the same amount of money to advertise.
What would the cap be?
Come up with your number. But the point is that
can we pass a law so we regulate how much it is and put a cap on it? That's a good idea.
But the other piece of this,
let the House
piece of this, and I would argue one of the reasons that Mark Zuckerberg has pursued this sort of open policy on advertising is that he's anxious that if he were to actually police the advertising, that he would be then regulated effectively by policymakers who'd be upset about
how he's
approaching this.
Well, you've already seen the Trump campaign's approach
to
this.
They're issue.
Upset with what happens with this because they have some money to spend on this. But I have to say, this whole thing is a lot of political theater. I mean, you said from the top,
right.
This is they're able to do this because it's not a significant portion
for Twitter,
of their advertising
not, but
revenue.
I think there's a
it's
much larger
$3
issue
dollars.
Here.
Much larger issue, but he intentionally did this trolling.
Oh, he did it, by the way,
did it
at 4 p.m. at the time
before,
that
as, Facebook
is announcing their earnings.
I mean, this was an entirely set up to troll, and there are these battles that are taking place in Silicon Valley right now when you have Tim Cook who's spouting off about privacy and saying, we stand by privacy.
I think trolling is, I don't know if it's trolling per se.
It was totally trolling.
Talk to me like the day before the election about whether I want to ban political ads.
You will have seen enough by
after
then.
I got to draw you pictures
for everything. Are you thinking Clockwork Orange?
Yeah.
Eyes wide open.
Like the last 2 months of the local like, stuff going out in New Jersey, and it's like.
I'm already getting it for Election Day next week, on Tuesday.
I know,
week,
but it's kind of an. It's kind of, you're already getting bombarded.
The stuff that comes into
to some degree, unlike what Barry said yesterday, you know, Barry Diller made this reference that somehow none of these ads are policed. And that's not exactly right. Most of these ads actually are policed by broadcasters, by the cable networks, and there have been ads that President Trump has tried to put on the air that have been blocked.
Only at CNN.
There have been other ads that have been blocked, and I imagine that if there was a responsible policing party in between here, you would have that. But we don't.
So
do
mean, we want,
you have
so
to decide
but here's
what you
the, here's
do.
The answer. Like, the broadcasters are actually bound by federal law. Mark Zuckerberg would like to see social media bound by social law. He wants somebody else to set the rules, not him. And that becomes the question.
Okay, but I think that Joe doesn't want regulation either. I don't know. Do you want ads regulated for the truth?
I'm with Barry. I mean, I'm a big boy. I'll figure out whether it's true or not. You know what I mean? And a lot of things I like to believe anyway, even if they aren't true.
But that's the problem, Joe.
I'm kidding. I know I'm kidding. And for Dorsey, it's worth this much to him, and it's worth this much to Zuckerberg. So
although Zuckerberg said that it's not worth that much to him either. It's 0.05.
But I think it's worth actually a lot more to Zuckerberg in a different way. It's not about the financials in the advertising itself. It's in what's going to happen to his company if it's regulated in a more meaningful way. And I do believe that part of his position is about placating a certain part of the political class that has otherwise been against him.
And I will add to it that Dorsey doing this steps up the political pressure on Zuckerberg with trying to come up with some solution or face being regulated.
I'll make also just one quick observation. Facebook, core Facebook, mm-hmm. is actually, Joe, a very, very, what I call it, should be called conservative Facebook. You look at the top 10 things that are shared on Facebook on any given day.
That would be hard for me to do.
And it's Breitbart, and it's Ben Shapiro, and it's the Daily. I mean, that's what it is. And so if you really understand who he's trying to placate, it's not the people in Silicon Valley. It's a very different group. That's what's happening here.
I don't like any ads on Twitter, and I feel violated. It's like, I don't follow this person. Who is this? I don't follow them. And then it says an ad, and I feel violated. But
can you just go to our ad?
To what?
We've got an ad.
We had to go to advertising.
Cheese will be next.
Next on Squawk Pod, the congressman who wants to remove flavored e-cigarettes from store shelves.
I think the costs of allowing more youth to vape far exceed the benefits of certain preferences that adults have. Our kids are not for sale.
We're back after this.
Stand Andrew by in 5 seconds.
Four, welcome back
three,
to Squawk Pod.
Two, one, up and Andrew. Cue, please, Mike.
Good morning and welcome to Squawk Box right here on CNBC. I'm Andrew Ross Sorkin along with Becky Quick and Joe Kernan. Take a look at U.S. equity futures at this hour.
Next, e-cigarettes. In September, the Trump administration announced plans to pull flavored nicotine pods off store shelves. It's the flavors like fruit, mint, and menthol that vaping opponents say appeal to children. And 6 weeks later, no further details have come from the White House about the ban, its timing, or what products will be affected. Raja Krishnamurti, a Democratic congressman from Illinois, is overseeing an investigation into e-cig maker Juul Labs. About 80% of Juul's U.S. sales come from flavored e-cigarettes. As you'll hear, he is passionate about stemming a tobacco epidemic among kids.
28% of high schoolers are vaping, and 5% of middle schoolers are vaping.
And has written a letter to the White House urging the flavored vape ban be finalized and implemented by next week.
Joining us right now is Congressman Raja Krishnamoorthy. He wrote the letter to the administration and is leading the charge among Congress. And Congressman, thank you for being here today.
Good morning.
So what have you heard back from the administration, from the White House, since sending that letter?
We haven't heard back anything yet. And the reason why we wrote the letter is that about 6 weeks ago, the White House and President Trump, citing our investigation, proposed a ban on all flavored e-cigarettes, which are what really primarily attract youth to vaping. Unfortunately, despite saying that we'd see a regulation within a couple weeks of that announcement, which was 6 weeks ago, we haven't seen anything. And so we wrote this letter yesterday asking the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs at the White House to basically come up with this rule within the next 10 days, as they have in the past with other regulations, because it's so important that we put this in effect ASAP to prevent more kids from vaping.
What happened? Why the delay? What do you think happened behind the scenes?
We don't know. Honestly, we don't know. And what I fear is that members of the industry are basically lobbying against putting out the rule or putting in exclusions within the rule for certain flavors, namely mint and menthol. Mint is the most popular flavor right now for e-cigarettes, and it's also the most popular flavor for youth who vape. And there's a reason why mint is in our children's toothpaste, because it's very appealing to kids. And so we want to make sure there are no exclusions, and we put this rule out ASAP.
Mint is the most popular flavor among children who are doing this too?
Yes, ma'am. 90% of youth who take up vaping take up flavored e-cigarettes, and 60% of youth are actually using mint e-cigarettes. And so this is something that, you know, as a parent of three children, I'm very, very personally concerned about, as I'm sure many of your viewers are.
The argument for keeping mint or menthol flavors in has been that adults who are trying to quit smoking, that that's the most popular flavor for them as well. How do you balance those two arguments?
Sure. I think the costs of allowing more youth to vape far exceed the benefits of certain preferences that adults have. I'll just give you a couple statistics. Maybe your viewers are already familiar with it. 28% of high schoolers are vaping, and 5% of middle schoolers are vaping. And these statistics are alarming, and the trend is not good. It's growing by the day. And so I just think we have to put a stop to this. You know, our kids are not for sale.
Have you looked into these recent reports that suggest that Juul was actually knowingly selling tainted or outdated materials? And there's a whistleblower who used to work at the company who has charged that.
I'm not aware of the specific allegations. We haven't investigated them yet. However, it's very disturbing to know that a company would, in the first place, sell such products, and then secondly, continue to do the things that we uncovered in our investigation, such as going into schools, paying high school districts and other schools to basically go in and basically present their products as safer than they are. That's what we revealed in our investigation. We're asking for further documents from Juul about this and other issues, and I'm sure that we're going to be following up with them very soon as well.
If the administration comes back with a rule that allows mint or menthol to continue, what will your response be?
Well, I think that obviously we're going to lobby heavily for that not to happen. But if it does happen, I think you're going to see legislation which basically calls for ending those exemptions to the flavor ban and making them permanent.
Congressman, it's good to see you today. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thank you. Have a great day.
You too.
Next, the social media dilemma. What makes our platforms wonderful may also make them dangerous. One of the first investors in the internet, Jeff Yang.
People are abusing it. I don't think our industry is really prepared for all the ramifications.
Squawk Pod. We'll be right back.
Stand by, Joe, in 5 seconds.
This is Squawk Pod.
3, 2, 1. His mic here.
Our guest host, Jeff Yang, founding partner of Redpoint Ventures, AT&T board member. Friend of the show.
Thanks for having me.
You are welcome.
Venture capitalist Jeff Yang is a veteran of Silicon Valley.
He was funding companies in the 90s when the internet was still a novelty, and he believed so strongly in this techie unknown that he made a contrarian move in the thick of the dot-com boom before the bust. It was such a newsy decision that CNBC covered it 20 years ago. Let's rewind to 1999.
Hi, everybody. I'm Bob Sellers, and this is Power Lunch. Nowhere is the internet's growing presence more evident than on Sand Hill Road, the epicenter of Silicon Valley's venture firms. These VC shops have pumped billions and billions of dollars into internet startups this year alone. An exclusive report in the Wall Street Journal today reports that partners at two major VC firms have decided to put all their eggs into the internet-only basket by forming a pure-play VC shop. Here with the exclusive details is Wall Street Journal reporter Kara Swisher. Is there a danger here?
Well, yeah. I mean, if the sector slips, if the IPO market continues to be weak, they're only funding internet companies, they don't have other things to fall back on.
That pure-play VC? That's Jeff Yang's Redpoint Ventures. Although back in 1999, he and his co-founders called it Project T-Rex. The firm survived that name, the dot-com boom, the subsequent bust, and everything since. Here's Jeff Yang on Squawk Box today.
What is the current state of tech right now? A year ago, I felt like it was unstoppable, and it was the future, and that mankind was going to benefit, and we were all going to just go into the future singing and all together. Now it's so contentious, so many different issues, so many different things that on a daily basis we even argue about, political, privacy,
right.
Libra, all these different things happening.
Well, so certainly we're in the hot seat. There's no question. I believe in the long-term ramifications of what technology can do in bringing productivity improvements, bringing new ways of doing things, disrupting industries. And I think that long-term trend is definitely intact, but it's clear that the profile of the technology industry, and maybe we've gotten a little bit ahead of ourselves, particularly as it relates to certain public policy matters and the effect on opinion and the effect on disruption. We're definitely under fire, and so I think it's very hard to ignore those realities of what we're facing. And you kind of have to understand it, or at least have an appreciation of where it might go. And right now, there's a lot of uncertainty.
What do you mean when you say we could have gotten ahead of ourselves? What, you mean you guys are? It's that move fast and break things sort of ethos that
yeah.
Maybe it's
and you look at Facebook as an example. I mean, its global reach is astounding, and what you can do, the good that you can do on the platform and reconnecting people. With others and sharing opinions and reflections with like minds is absolutely a wonderful thing. I mean, it's analogous to kind of what the telephone network was. But the flip side of it is people are abusing it, and there are a lot of people with black hats that are doing things that were unintended consequences of the same wonderful platform. And I think, I don't think our industry is really prepared for all the ramifications of
it. It's interesting that you bring up the telephone industry, because that was eventually broken up. You think that happens here?
So, and specifically with regard to Facebook?
Facebook, I think, is probably the target number one, right. But you can point to probably four or five other big companies.
Sure. So let's talk about Facebook for a second. So I think the first thing to understand is that by its nature, it's a natural network effect business, a little bit like marketplaces. In other words, it's useful because everybody's on it, and because
right.
everybody's on it, you want to be on it, right? If others weren't on it, you wouldn't want to be on it. So
unless you're Yogi Berra,
yeah.
Nobody goes there anymore. It's too crowded.
Exactly, but it's one of these things where, kind of by its nature, if it's successful, it's going to be a highly concentrated business. So, like marketplaces, I think you're likely to see businesses that have real value if a lot of people are on it. So then the question is it too big, right? And should it be broken up? And one thing, just kind of conceptually, my belief is that it provides a lot of great things, just like a communications network provides a lot of great things, and being able to link everybody to anybody else. And how great would it be if you picked up the phone and only a third of the people, were on it? It would have much less value. So you got to be careful and think about the good that it's doing, not just the harm that it's doing, right?
But the question that I'd ask is, there have been some very controversial decisions that Mark Zuckerberg has made,
yes.
including around political advertising and other things.
Yes.
that he has done, arguably even he would say or suggest it's more for philosophical reasons necessarily than even economic ones. I don't know if that's right or wrong. But do you think that he's just, I mean, would you agree, for example, with him or would you agree with Jack Dorsey at Twitter in terms of how you think about some of these issues?
Personally, I mean, we are plowing new ground from a public policy perspective, and Facebook in particular is, you know, at the very forefront trying to figure out, you know, what's right. And I think regulators are trying to figure out, hey, what's the best thing to do? And I think the reality is that the regulators are always going to be behind, you know, the platform. And so something has to be done, right? And that's a lot of the public outcry, I think, for you know, the argument for breaking it up. And when you, but I do think there have to be more rules of the road. And when you ask about the question of do I think it'll be broken up, as I look into the subject about kind of antitrust, and I don't really know nearly enough, only enough to kind of be dangerous, I think it's kind of a little bit of a murky argument about what the consumer harm is, you know, on a free service. And so then you go to restraint of trade and market power. And I think it's a hard argument to make, as I understand it, from a legal perspective, because antitrust laws and antitrust framework wasn't really contemplated for this type of environment.
I would have said the same thing about AT&T Time Warner, though.
Okay, like, fair enough.
You know, we may be dealing with new rules that are getting made up along the way.
I understand, but yeah. we're dealing with the new rules that are being made up as we go along versus traditional case law and
right.
traditional framework.
Right.
So then, but I think there are definitely issues as regard to privacy, with regard to data portability, and with regard to freedom of speech. And I distinguish freedom of speech from freedom of expression, right? You know, it's kind of the yelling fire in a theater, you know, issue. And I think there have to be rules of the road on what is acceptable speech. I think there need to be rules of the road in terms of privacy, and there need to be rules of the road in terms of data portability. Right. But I think all those can be handled outside the framework of a breakup.
AT&T this week is rolling out HBO Max. What we're looking at, what's expected, mm-hmm. Huge library, lots of stuff that they're cramming into it, but it's also a fairly high price point at almost $15. Talk about what this means for AT&T and what you think about the service and the strategy.
Well, you know, I was at the announcement yesterday, I guess, or the day before yesterday, and I just thought it was an incredibly impressive, you know, announcement. A lot of people have been talking.
There's
a lot of stuff in it. And the library of HBO is kind of unparalleled. I mean, they were really the first to define kind of premium, you know, original content. And then when you layer on top of that the Warner Brothers library, Warner Brothers Television, Warner Brothers Pictures, and then the original stuff that's coming, as well as, you know, things from Cartoon Network. I was just blown away by the actual amount of content and the breadth of content. And, you know, it may not be the most in terms of actual aggregate number of hours, but I think it's maybe the broadest in terms of breadth.
Yesterday, my son was like, you know, this is a big day for HBO Plus. He goes, everything is on at debt, everything, but it's really expensive. And I go, well, how much? And I knew. And it was $15. And
same as HBO was currently.
And he said, but we have to get it. I mean, so he said.
That's great.
Huh?
But you already have it.
Well, I know.
I mean, that to me.
But if we didn't, we'd have to. We would.
Right, but to me, that's.
Do other people say that, though, that it's 15, but we have to have it, so I'm not worried that it's not 5? I mean, we're arguing about when is it is there any inelasticity to something that you really want?
Well, that was the question I was going to ask. Yeah. You look at this and say, consumers are going to have Netflix. To me, mm-hmm. this is a Netflix versus HBO Max kind of product, as opposed to Disney Plus, I put in a separate category. Mm-hmm. Apple Plus, I think, given the library or lack of library, is sort of a smaller add-on.
Mm-hmm. Peacock's free. Mm-hmm.
Peacock's free. And then there's Hulu. So there's sort of Hulu, Netflix, HBO Max.
Right.
Do you think that consumers buy one, they buy two? How do you think about that?
I think consumers end up probably settling in a multiples.
Okay.
And I think it's somewhere, I would guess it's around 3. You know, and obviously there's, you know, the number is probably less important than the aggregate price that you're paying. But I do think that no one's going to get everything out of a single service, and having the diversity of things to choose from and having multiples. Now, at some point, people get subscription fatigue, you know, just logging into different things and kind of managing and figuring out where to look and all that kind of stuff.
Let me ask you, when AT&T bought Time Warner, part of the plan was not only for HBO to continue at a $15 price point, but to actually create a new product with at an incrementally higher price point. So it wasn't just going to be a volume story. It was going to be volume plus.
Right.
Now we're only at a volume story. How does that change the equation in terms of your whole thought process around this deal?
Well, I also think that it's at launch,
right?
And then over time, the question will be, you know, can you add more value that might support, you know, being able to raise prices or have an even higher, you know, tier service as well as maybe a lower tier service.
Jeff Yang of Redpoint Ventures, it's been great having you here. We will see you back again soon.
That's the show for today. Happy Halloween.
Yeah, we haven't even mentioned it.
We haven't even mentioned Happy Halloween, everybody.
Happy birthday, Penelope.
What are you...
Just hold on a second. Happy birthday,
Happy
Penelope.
Happy birthday, Penelope.
Thank you.
What are you going as?
You just go in one building, right?
No, we go to multiple buildings.
You can go, but it's easier in New York to go just door to door.
Yeah.
You know, out where I live, it might take 10 minutes to walk between, you know, houses, you know, the driveway.
Yeah.
And then you got to...
Man of the people.
You got to get buzzed in.
Squawk Box is hosted by Joe Kernan, Becky Quick, and Andrew Ross Sorkin. Tune in weekday mornings on CNBC at 6 a.m. Eastern. To get the smartest takes and analysis from our TV show right into your ears, subscribe to Squawk Pod on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, wherever you listen. We'll meet you back here tomorrow.
Clear. Thanks, guys.